Welcome. Good morning. Thank you. I'm glad you're all here. My name is John Hamry. Oh, God, I made a mess. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS, but it's my pleasure here to welcome David and Undersecretary of Commerce and for what I think is going to be a very important discussion. And I'm delighted that you agreed to be with us this morning, David, to give us a bit of policy perspective on your recent trip and also your thinking about these very, very important matters. We really are very pleased. I was talking to Bill Reinsch. Everybody knows Bill Reinsch, I think, twice removed or three times removed had David's job. And Bill said in his typical graceful way, he says, well, this is unlike most CSIS events. This one may matter. So and I thought, I agree with that. I think this is a very important subject and a very important day. You know, it's typical in the interagency process that we get to collective truth by forcing different points of view together in the coordination process, and that's where I met Bill. And we were, you know, happy gladiators against each other, as the interagency process is. You know, I would go, you know, battling for DOD, thinking that he was neglecting America's security, and he was battling for commerce, knowing that I didn't know a damn thing about business. And it was, you know, so we were trying to find a collective truth that transcended our respective biases. It's happy for me to say that David McCormick doesn't need that. This is a guy who brings both of those dimensions honestly to the table just inside himself. He served honorably and very, very ably as an Army officer in Desert Storm, Desert One. And in that capacity did what too few Americans now do. He personally put his own life on the line to defend the country. And that brings, in my mind, endless credibility to talk about these issues of how America should manage its control of its economic side in conjunction with its national security interests. And this is an area, frankly, that's not informed by enough sincerity or objectivity. It tends to be too much shaped by again, people's partisan views that they want to bring to a fight, partisan for your institution, not this isn't a Republican-Democrat thing. This is partisan for your institution. And then hope that out of the clash that some greater truth is going to emerge. This is too important, frankly, for it to be lost in just that kind of a process. And, David, I want to personally thank you for being willing to take on this this responsibility, not just as the undersecretary, but also the responsibility of hammering out constructive policies for our country in a very tough area. I mean, you come having served your country in uniform. You went out and became successful in the private sector, so you understand the imperatives of that as well, and that America's security is more determined by its economic vitality than it is by how many aircraft carriers we have. You know, I mean, ultimately, that's the underpinning of our security. And so it's striking a balance between these two. And you've been doing that in your tenure that you've been at Commerce. And I'm delighted that you're here today. I think you're going to make news. We've got cameras here. So you're going to make news, I hope, but it's to shape and help us inform this debate we need to have here in Washington. So without taking away further from what I think is the real highlight of this, I introduce to you David McCormick, Undersecretary of Commerce. Thank you, David, for coming today. Delighted to be here.
Well, thank you, John, for that very nice introduction. And thank you to CSIS and all of you for being here today. I don't know whether to be flattered or a little bit frightened that this topic seems to generate so much interest. But regardless of what your motives are for being here, I'm absolutely delighted to be able to talk about U.S.-China policy, and specifically high-technology trade. You know, the emergence of China as a major economic power is one of the most important developments of the 21st century. It requires a review of many facets of U.S. policy. And how the United States deals with China's growing influence is a central question not only for this administration, but also for future generations of Americans. The Bush administration has responded to China's rise by encouraging it to act as a responsible stakeholder. That is, to take greater responsibility for the health and success of the global system. And this is a global system from which China has greatly benefited. Our goal is straightforward, that China's development be both peaceful and prosperous. And U.S. export control policies that facilitate legitimate civilian high technology trade while discouraging China's military buildup are critical to this objective. Now, achieving this careful balance requires not only looking at what technologies are being sold, but also for what purpose and to whom. The same product that's benign when it's used for civilian purposes could be problematic if used for military ones. For example, U.S. policy should facilitate the sale of American-made semiconductors to companies in China when they're going to be used in stereos or a child's Game Boy, but not for advanced missile systems or for submarines. So with that example in mind, my argument today is a very simple one. We can do both. Strengthening our economic interest and our security interest in China need not be a zero-sum game. Today I will describe an update to our U.S. export control policy that advances both U.S. security interest and U.S. economic interest. And in doing so, this is a policy that encourages China to be a responsible stakeholder now and into the future. You know, the rapid economic growth and expansion of U.S.-China cooperation presents enormous opportunities for both countries. Today, China is the United States' third largest trading partner, with $285 billion of trade in 2005. And by most relevant measures, China's GDP is roughly $2.3 trillion. That's the world's fourth largest economy behind Japan, the United States, and Germany. Yet this newfound prosperity is unevenly distributed. Although the World Bank recently found that the proportion of Chinese living in poverty has fallen dramatically over the last 20 years, there are still in China 160 million people today that live on less than $1 a day. And this growing disparity in wealth has created social tensions within China. And thus the Chinese leadership is finding that with this new wealth comes new obligations. And expanding this ring of prosperity from the wealthy coastal cities into central China and to western China has become a critical step in China's development. And technology is a critical component of China's next phase in this transformation. And from my discussions with Chinese officials on a recent trip a couple weeks ago, I can assure you that China's leadership recognizes this challenge better than anyone. Now, to highlight the challenge, but also the opportunity, let me talk for a minute about the ARJ-21 regional jet program. This is interesting because it's in a consortium of Chinese aircraft manufacturers and 10 American companies. And these 10 American companies are providing the majority of the components that will be used in this project. This collaborative effort is no small feat. The program was created as a consequence of China's plan to build 100 new airports in the coming decade in order to bind their company together because of the absence of comprehensive roads and comprehensive rail connections. And this strategy also requires, I'm told, hundreds of new jet aircraft that will need to be produced in the coming years. Now, U.S. technology is absolutely critical to fulfilling this need and in helping to develop this project. And this is a project, for all the reasons I just described, that's critical to China's development. Now, while it's important to China, programs like this are also extremely important to the United States. This program will benefit American companies with near-term profits. But more important, it will help the United States maintain leadership. And if I could say as an aside, this is leadership that's absolutely critical to national security – in the manufacture of high-technology aerospace products. Opportunities such as this in China are plentiful, and I'm happy to say that American companies are capturing many of them. Since China became a WTO member in 2001, U.S. exports to China have grown five times faster than to the rest of the world, and technology exports have been a key driver of this growth. Top exports to China from the United States range from electrical machinery and electrical components to power generation equipment. In 2004 alone, the United States exported $2.9 billion worth of semiconductors to China. And this and related electronics markets in particular are growing at a blistering pace. But it's also important to note that these exports create jobs at home. As an example, Caterpillar has over the last few years increased its sales to China by 40%. And this has helped to create some 5,000 new jobs in the United States. In short, a fair and growing U.S.-China trading relationship will be a critical factor of the economic and political successes of both countries. And we must find ways to encourage legitimate civilian technology trade. Yet, in spite of all this great opportunity, there are very real challenges. We must have a very careful and a very candid dialogue with China about areas of concern. And let me highlight several of them. Intellectual property rights remain a very, very important topic. The foundation of America's competitiveness is a knowledge-based, innovation-driven economy. And that economy depends not only on a well-educated and highly skilled workforce. It depends on global intellectual property protection. A responsible stakeholder should not tolerate widespread theft of intellectual property. And not only is piracy of ideas rampant in China, but also two-thirds of the phony goods seized by U.S. Customs come from China. We also know that 90% of the software sold within China is pirated. Intellectual property rights are also a critical priority for China's own indigenous technology industry. And China's most successful high technology companies recognize this. For example, the chief technology officer of Huawei, who I visited with just a couple weeks ago, and as some of you may know, Huawei is a Chinese company with what many would view as a mixed history on intellectual property protection. But he recently expressed to me the concerns that Huawei has about its inventions, its next generation of technology being stolen by Chinese companies. While I was in China, I sat down with the chairman of Lenovo, and he voiced his reservations about the protection of the intellectual property in the next generation of Lenovo products. President Bush, Commerce Secretary Gutierrez, Ambassador Schwab have all made clear that rigorous intellectual property protection is a crucial building block of strengthening U.S.-China relations. And this is, and will continue to be, an important component of our ongoing discussions with China. Human rights is another issue of concern. Acting as a responsible stakeholder goes beyond economics. It also requires a renewed emphasis on human rights. And we will continue to encourage China's leaders to implement a system that's based on the rule of law, and to reform its judiciary not only for investment and economic reasons, but for reasons of human rights. Although there is much greater economic openness in China, the political system remains closed, and this is a feature of that society that history and logic would suggest is unsustainable. As China continues to develop, more and more Chinese will seek a greater say in their future, and they'll push for improvements in China's weak protection of individual rights. These issues have been crystallized recently in articles regarding internet censorship. How can one open a society to trade and to maximize the flow of information that requires, but at the same time maintain the political restrictions that China has sought to impose? In the long run, I would suggest to you cannot. And finally, as President Bush has discussed with President Hu, the United States will also continue to urge China to open possibilities for greater religious freedom. Ultimately, it will be in China's interest to move toward a more open, rights-based society. Now, China's military modernization is a third area of concern, and it's one that's particularly central to export control policy. As documented in a recent RAND study, China has a clear strategy, a strategy to strengthen its military capabilities by acquiring advanced dual-use technologies and incorporating them into defense systems. And it's important to note that China's investment and its growing and non-transparent military budget has grown much faster than China's overall economy. From 1994 to 2004, China's GDP grew at an average rate of about 10%, while its declared, its public military budget, grew at an average annual rate of 16%, meaning that by 2005, that budget could be as high as $90 billion. This would place China in third in global defense spending, behind the United States and Russia. As also stated in a recent defense report, Defense Department report, China's capabilities could pose a credible threat to other modern militaries operating in the region if current trends persist. We know that China has focused on obtaining high-tech military acquisitions in order to build missile capabilities and its naval forces. And also of concern, China's record on non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction has been far, far from perfect. So as a consequence of this uncertainty, uncertainty in both capabilities and intentions, the United States and other countries in this region must by necessity hedge their bets. For example, the cutting-edge composite technology that helps China build commercial aircraft must not also find its way into the Super 7 next-generation fighter aircraft. Therefore, U.S. policy, and in particular, U.S. export control policy, must reflect this caution, and it must reflect this concern. Our changes to China export control policy will do just that by achieving two very complementary objectives: the growth in civilian high-technology trade and enhanced security. The Bureau of Industry and Security has made real progress in evolving our strategic trade controls over the last several years in ways that have been beneficial both for the United States and for China. A most recent example is the announcement during the JCCT of the High-Tech Strategic Trade Working Group. This has a specific mission of improving the effectiveness of export controls on both sides and growing legitimate civilian high-technology trade. And we have an increasingly healthy high-tech trading relationship with China. In 2005, there were over $12 billion of high-tech exports from the United States to China. Now, for certain technologies, our new policy will free future trade of dual-use items with certified importers in China for civilian purposes. U.S. exporters seeking to grow market share in critical sectors, semiconductors and electronics, to name a few, will be spared the need to apply for licenses for potentially hundreds of millions of dollars worth of sales to these companies in China. This aspect of our policy, however, not only frees up legitimate high-technology trade, it also increases U.S. security by ensuring closer scrutiny of key technology purchasers in China. To become eligible for this program, Chinese companies would need to demonstrate an established record of non-proliferation and of responsible use of U.S. civilian imports. The process will require unprecedented openness and cooperation on the part of Chinese companies, and it will create incentives, market-based incentives, for them to demonstrate good faith and sound practices. In addition, and this is very, very important, it will allow U.S. government officials to focus time and energy on more complex cases with far greater implications for national security. This new policy will also bolster U.S. security by preventing exports of technologies for incorporation into Chinese weapon systems. This policy is not a wide-ranging catch-all regulation that subjects everything from fountain pens to office furniture to government scrutiny. Rather, these changes carefully target certain technologies that, while unrestricted up until now, have the potential to materially enhance China's military capabilities. This administration will also urge others, particularly in Europe and Japan, where I was after my trip to China, to follow similar steps. We will also continue to conduct on-the-ground spot checks in China to reduce the risk that civilian exports are diverted to third parties or to China's own military purposes. Given the Chinese military's appetite for cutting-edge technology, this approach is prudent. It's also fully consistent with America's longstanding embargo of military sales to China. And by denying only those exports that are destined for military use, the impact on industry will be lessened. The estimated cost in lost markets from this restriction is small. The gain in security, substantial. Ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, too often, policies involving national security and economic objectives are portrayed as zero-sum, requiring trade-offs that inevitably promote one at the expense of the other. These changes to technology export controls for China are truly a win-win. They enhance both U.S. economic and security interest, and they will encourage China to act as a responsible stakeholder now and into the future. I'd like to thank you for your interest in this important topic, and at this time I'd be happy to answer some questions.
And if I could ask the audience to please identify yourself when you ask a question, and if we can go ahead. There's someone with a microphone, too, if we could. Do we have questions? Oh, there's one. Go ahead.
Danielle Bell-Taske with National Journal's Tech Daily. Can you give us some examples of specific technologies that will be restricted?
Yeah, the proposed policy that I just outlined will be published in the coming weeks. It will affect roughly 47 categories of technology, and those categories would include some very specific types of high technology, avionics, and composites, and other things where our analysts within the U.S. government have determined that these could contribute in a meaningful way to China's military modernization.
Bill?
Bill Morin with Applied Materials. I'm just wondering, what was the reaction you got from the Chinese officials on your trip to this proposal?
Yeah, I would say a couple things. I spent a lot of time in China meeting with the business community, the American business community in China, as well as a number of days in Beijing meeting with Chinese officials. And I guess the first point I'd make is that the track record here over the last several years is pretty encouraging when you just look at the numbers. You look at some of the general purpose microprocessor decontrol. You look at the high performance computer metric recent decision. You look at the trade numbers in terms of the fact that high tech trade in the last 3 years has grown from $8 billion, high tech exports from $8 billion to $12 billion, 2003, 2004, 2005, and then the high tech working group that was just established. So you have some very tangible pieces of data that I think demonstrate to the Chinese a real commitment to trying to grow civilian high-tech trade. And when we talked about this, and as you probably gather from my remarks, there's some complexity in what we're trying to do here because we're trying to advance these two objectives. They were reserved. They wanted to spend more time with the specifics, but I think intrigued. I think it would be fair to say intrigued by the consistency of our message in terms of this is very consistent with longstanding U.S. policy and some of the creativity in terms of what we're trying to do. Like most things, I think the devil will be in the details here. So it will be 12 months from now, we'll look back on this and we'll say it was success or a failure based on our ability to actually facilitate legitimate civilian trade and based on the premise that I outlined for all of you that because of the way we've defined this policy, the implications for industry of the restrictions, the incremental restrictions, are in fact very, very small. So I think they're in probably a situation that many of you are in, which is they're saying, okay, now let's see it work.
How about the gentleman in the back there? Right, go ahead.
Rich Butel with Congressman Manzullo's office. Do you have a firm commitment from our Wassenaar partners to join in with these rules?
Well, we've certainly engaged in discussions with our Bostonar partners, and I think it would be fair to say that if you looked at Bostonar members today, there's in some cases uneven implementation of some of the understandings that have been reached. And I think we are committed as an administration to trying to encourage our Bostonar partners to implement a similar approach that we've implemented. I'm optimistic that we'll get some consistency with that, but I think it would be unrealistic to assume we're going to get universal and consistent implementation across all Bostonar members. But we're actively in those discussions already, and I was very encouraged. Let me say this. I was very encouraged by the discussions with the Japanese.
FT article this morning, and you just mentioned about, and I'd like to follow up the gentleman's question about coordination with in EU and Japan. My question is, next week, Alastair Darling, new DTI Secretary of State, will be here, and my question, A, either Secretary Gutierrez or you plan to meet with him to discuss these issues? B, and how would you address, implement this policy with the European Union? Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch who's going to be here next week.
DTI.
Alastair Darling, he is new Secretary of State of the Department of Trade Industry, which regulate military goods as well as goods technology for the UK government.
Yeah. Thanks for highlighting that. We may indeed include that in next week's talking points. It's always good to get that information in a public forum. You know, we have begun this active dialogue with our friends in Japan and our colleagues in Europe, and this is not an issue that's without complexity, and it's not an issue that's without agreement. Just to highlight that, I was in Asia and gave a press conference after some of the initial discussions, and when you lay out the leads on the stories from a half a dozen newspapers. After having that initial press conference, it was all over the map in terms of how people were interpreting what we're trying to do here. And that's why we're making such an effort to get out here and openly and very directly try to communicate where we're headed. The initial discussions happened with the Japanese. As I said, I was very encouraged. And we will continue that dialogue over the next several months with colleagues in Europe. In the EU, and I'll be part of that effort over in Europe in the coming months. And this has been an issue that's sort of been sitting out there for 24 months in terms of how Bostonar was going to think about it. And I think now that we've laid out our vision of where we think this policy should go and a process for making it work, that gives us the impetus to be able to have those discussions in a much more detailed way with the EU and Japan.
We can get one in the front.
Jim Berger from Washington Trade Daily. You spent a good part of your the speech on intellectual property rights and human rights. Now, how do these two issues translate into the bilateral high technology dialogue as well as the licensing system?
I think the short answer is they don't. The reason that I wanted to try to talk a little bit about other aspects of our U.S.-China policy is I think it's important with an issue like export control policy to make sure that it's clear to everyone how this fits into broader China policy. What I was trying to highlight was that this issue of military modernization and how our export control policy fits that is very consistent with the administration's overall direction around a very open and candid discussion about how China can be a responsible stakeholder in the future. And none of those concerns preclude a very real commitment to trying to increase legitimate civilian high-technology trade, which is in China's best interest and, as I tried to argue in my remarks, in United States' best interest.
Can we get one in the back there?
Berliner, Corcoran, and Rowe. David, how have you attempted to measure the likely effectiveness of this policy? I mean, what's our goal? Is our goal to prevent these exports or just to make sure made in the USA doesn't show there? Because, as you said, most of these haven't been controlled. The purpose of dual-use controls has been just for this purpose, and we haven't controlled these items either because they're so widespread, they're not very controllable, or they're low-tech and not very useful. And second, how have you attempted to measure the cost? Because while you mentioned there are few sales for actual military in use. Exporters have to screen in a much broader net to see if it's going to be for a military in use. And with China, that's really, really difficult to tell what's military and what's not, as you've noticed.
Well, I'm not sure I would completely agree with your characterization of the technologies in terms of the significance that they would have for military modernization. The objectives are twofold, as I tried to clarify in my remarks. On the part of our policy where we're trying to identify validated end users within China who to whom we would free up licensing requirements going forward, the goal is very simple. If you look at our licensing data, what you will see is there's a good bit of trade that goes back and forth between established suppliers and U.S. companies that goes through the same licensing process, although there's an established track record, we believe, of consistent, legitimate civilian use. And we don't think that's necessarily a good use of the resources of the U.S. government, and we think that there's a process for continuing to ensure that those exports are able to be used for civilian purposes and aren't being diverted without having the same licensing requirement that we have now. So the way that will be measured over time is are there legitimate Chinese companies, subsidiaries that go on that list and that really frees up the burden that many of you feel when you export to those companies, and do we have a credible process of ensuring that there isn't diversion? And I think you'll see that we have a real plan to make that work and that it'll have a real benefit for many people in this room. On the aspect of the incremental restrictions, we attacked it and tried to attack it in a very analytic way by understanding what percentage of 2005 trade do we think in those categories actually went to military end use. And this distinction I really want to highlight for this group. This discussion 12 months ago was talking about military end user. And that has real complexity in China, given the interdependence of a number of organizations. So this movement to military end use is explicitly meant to reduce the burden of this approach on industry while still capturing the security objective, which is that we do not want these technologies contributing directly to Chinese military modernization. Our assessment of those 2005 trade numbers would suggest the amount of trade that went to those types of end uses in 2005 was very, very small. And we came at this in a number of different ways. And that, frankly, has been verified by many in this room through our tax and through our other sources of feedback. So we're very conscious of trying to reduce the burden on industry, but this will require, as it has in the past, exporters to know that who their customer is, who their end user is, and that the use that that is planned for that item is, in fact, civilian use.
I think we have time for just a couple more questions. So if there would – how about if we get one over there?
Hi, I'm Felice Laird with Export Strategies, and just a follow-up to what Ben had asked, will you propose this as a proposed rule? You mentioned that the regs were coming out in a couple of weeks. Is that going to be proposed?
Yes, this will be a proposed rule. Thanks for asking that question. This will be a proposed rule. It will be posted for 120 days, so it has a significant comment period, and the comment period is because we want comments. We actually are welcome the feedback. We've spent a lot of time thinking about this. We've tried to be as analytic as possible. We've tried to be as data-driven as possible, but there may be data that all of you have that would help instruct this policy, and we welcome it.
One more. How about
in the back? Hi, Ann Broach with News.com. I was just hoping you could elaborate a little bit on the 47 categories that you all are considering and beyond avionics and those sorts of things. Are there any sort of consumer-level products that might be involved in this?
Well, I think probably not. I probably won't go into the list in any detail now. I would say that the break between consumer and non-consumer is probably not necessarily the way to think about it, because lots of these items can be used conceivably for consumer purposes as well as business-to-business transactions. It's a list that we've tried to frankly, pare down to only those technologies which our analysis would suggest really do contribute in a meaningful or could contribute in a meaningful way. And then within those categories, we've tried to also be very targeted about not restricting necessarily all the technologies in that category, but setting the limits of those that actually would contribute to military modernization. And again, it's a best attempt based on the data we have and our analysis of where there's a real contribution. And we welcome, once this is published, we welcome further feedback on it.
Okay.
I want to do one more question, and then we'll finish up. Thank you.
One more.
Well, in answer to the second part of your question first, absolutely the approved companies would be made public because our hope here is that this will not just benefit necessarily one business-to-business set of transactions, but it will actually identify companies within China where many in this room can potentially do business with those companies. So the idea would be that this is a list that that all of you would be aware of. Let me make clear one of the comments that people – have mentioned to me, if you're not on the list, you know, if the company to whom you're selling in China is not on the list, does that in effect mean that there's a new gray zone by which we have concerns about those certain companies? And the answer is explicitly not. There's a very specific set of criteria that will be articulated in the rule when it's published. And the idea is to identify those where there's minimal risk based on a long track record and confidence that can be demonstrated through transparency. And our hope would be that lots of companies can get on that list. And I think our burden and your burden as we work together is to determine that criteria in a very specific way and ultimately have those companies on the list and create a process by which our confidence can continue to be there over time. And we view this as of great benefit. And again, if you look at the construct and the way export controls have worked in the past, this is a pretty significant deviation from the way that this has been managed. And I think it creates the right kind of incentive structure and ultimately focuses our efforts in the U.S. government on the areas where there's the biggest risk, which is, I think is both business people and Americans is probably where you want us to be. Let me stop on that point, and again, thank you for your interest in this topic. I suspect we will, among many of us, talk about this again. I look forward to that, and thank you for your time today.